This is JumbleThink.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to JumbleThink, where we interview dreamers, makers, innovators, and influencers all about their journey of turning dreams and ideas into reality. Along the way, we're going to share some tips on how you can turn your own dreams and ideas into reality, too. On today's show, we are talking to Dennis and Ricardo, founders of Paid Exposure, along with taking a look back at Season 3. Whether you're a new listener or a longtime fan, if you haven't subscribed to JumbleThink, you should go do it. What do? Head on over to your favorite place to listen to podcasts, search for JumbleThink, and click subscribe. Now let's jump into today's conversation. Hey there, welcome to JumbleThink. My name is Michael Woodward. I am your host. We have a great show lined up for you today. Today's show is being sponsored by our friends over at Penji. Penji is your source for unlimited graphic design at a low subscription rate. They're doing great things, and they want to help you get the design you want. All you have to do is head on over to Penji, PENJI.co. And when you use the code Jumble, as a listener of JumbleThink, they're going to give you 15% off your first month. Today's show, we are changing it up a little bit. We're changing it up because this is the final show of Season 3. But you're not going to have to wait long for Season 4. We're kicking that off at the end of this week. We're doing a preview show and a brand new guest interview with Jen Lederer. She's a comedian. It's super fun. It's going to be a double episode day. And then we're going to jump into Season 4 with some killer, killer guests. Season 3, though, to wrap it up, we're not just bringing you a look back at some of our favorite interviews. We're also bringing you a brand new interview with the guys from Paid Exposure. And then we're going to take a look back at some of our favorite moments from Season 3. To kick off today's show, we are doing a micro interview from an event called Propelify Innovation Festival, hosted in Jersey City, Hoboken area of New Jersey, overlooking Lower Manhattan. This interview was recorded live at that event. You're going to hear the noise of the event in the background. We had incredible conversations with a lot of amazing people, and you're going to hear some of those interviews in the weeks to come, but this micro interview was a quick one we did at the end of the day. The day was crazy cold and rainy, and it was the first real day of fall, but it was a lot of fun. If you want to know more about Propelify, you can check it out at propelify.com. That's PROPELIFY.com. This interview was also in partnership with our friends over at Podcast Row. You can check out Podcast Row at podcast-row.com. Our first interview from Propelify is with Ricardo and Dennis of Paid Exposure. This is a micro interview at the end of the day that we did. Paid Exposure is an influencer marketing platform. A lot of influencers have done a great job at growing their followers, but only those with a massive following can make a living off of it. However, micro influencers with less than 100,000 followers are becoming more popular for sponsors because of their high engagement rate and their lower sponsorship rates. Let's go ahead and jump into our conversation with Ricardo and Dennis of Paid Exposure. We are here with Ricardo and Dennis from Paid Exposure. Hey guys, how you doing?
Good. How's it going?
Thanks for jumping in with us. We're at Propelify doing some stuff with Podcast Row.
This is a little
fun interview here. Thanks for taking time out.
Yeah, definitely.
Thank you. Awesome, thank you.
You have a cool company. It's called Paid Exposure.
Yeah.
You're all about helping influencers get their business in order and get the sponsors that they need.
Yes. Yeah, we found that influencers need a lot of help trying to monetize their followers because a lot of them lack business experience, right?
Yeah.
That's why it takes so long to like negotiate promotions because they're not treating it enough as a business.
Yeah.
So we provide the platform. It's actually a marketplace that helps the influencers manage their own business and at the same time increase sponsorships by connecting them with sponsors that are looking for the exposure.
But you don't just do that. You have some more to the platform to help them with the business side of things. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so one of the things that really helped, because there's no trust, right?
Right.
So what you need is to build the trust.
Yeah.
So you need transparency. Right now, it's like Airbnb with just a picture. And you have to go back and forth like, hey, is there a room, a pool? So we provide that professional listing so you can actually have detailed listings.
Yeah.
Another thing is the credibility. we provide you with the ratings and reviews. So if you see an influencer with a 5-star review and 50 sponsors, you're in.
What gets influencers stars or ratings? What does that mean?
So basically, it's just like Uber, Airbnb, right?
Yeah.
After they do their promotion, the sponsors are allowed, are basically get to rate and review them. Whenever you do that, the quality always increases.
So when they're rating and reviewing, are they rating for conversion? They're rating for timeliness?
So there's three things. One is communication.
Okay.
How well they communicate with each other.
Yeah.
One is the quality of the content.
Okay.
And then one is the effectiveness, the ROI, things like that.
What do you see the average rating being for your influencers?
Oh, God. Well, all of them, I'm hoping, like Uber drivers, they want that 5-star, man.
Yeah. But what are you seeing at, on the platform right now?
Oh, on the platform right now, I mean, God, it's probably threes because the communication sucks. That's why it takes forever.
Yeah.
The quality is obviously there, or else you wouldn't even go to them.
Yeah.
The effectiveness is tough to measure.
Okay.
Everyone's having a hard time with that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So tell us about how you got this idea. Where did it start from? How did that all happen?
So I own an apparel company.
Okay.
And that's where we kind of learned, you know, dealing with influencers. It's always, so how much is it? Well, that depends. What do you mean? Like, what does that include? What's like, tell me. These are the same questions you're going to keep getting asked. So why don't you have this ready?
Yeah.
So the best thing they can do is, like, give you, like, a media kit.
Yeah.
But the thing is, they made it.
Yeah.
So it's like, all right, of course you work with Calvin Klein. You know what I mean? Like, how do I know that? There's no proof.
Yeah.
That's why the showing the sponsor history and the ratings reviews help. Because that credibility from a third party is just more powerful, you know?
Yeah. Now, tell us a little bit about the process of developing a platform, because platforms can be tricky. I've built them for customers, so I understand this.
Right.
Talk to us a little bit about that process of really honing in a platform that brings value to the influencers, that helps your sponsors know that they're able to use it and get what they want out of it.
Yeah, yeah. So we started off, you know, just basically what I learned. But what really helped, we actually went through a UX third party.
Yeah.
To really get to know. What's awesome is, like, they validated all of our assumptions.
Okay.
And I actually went to Founder Institute. So it helped me realize, you know, all the assumptions that we had were actually true. So I'm like, awesome. So they really helped us really validate everything, how it should work. And it's such a new platform that influencers don't really know how to kind of do anything.
Yeah.
And they were kind of basing it off their experience. So I kind of had to tell them, like, this is so new, though. Like, they don't have a calendar. They don't have a management platform. They, like, you can't go by what they do on paper right now.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
So that was kind of hard, actually.
What's your big goal for this? Where do you want to see this business go?
Yeah, so the big vision, because I want to empower anyone who can provide valuable exposure.
Yeah.
And the same reason, like, you know, how Airbnb and Uber helps people meet, like, ends meet, you know, or help them make ends meet, all you need is a phone.
Yeah.
So to me, I think anyone can really make money just using your mobile phone.
Yeah.
So if I can get everyone, because if you can keep that within the ecosystem, even locally especially, and, you know, instead of giving the dollars to Facebook, you should give it to the people that's in your community.
Yeah.
You know?
The influencer space is a very interesting space. And I think that we're seeing the fruit of misunderstanding kind of hit us right now.
Oh, what is it?
The fruit of the fallout from misunderstanding of what influencer space actually is.
Yeah, yeah.
It's easy to say I'm an influencer.
Yeah.
But the reality is a lot of people aren't.
Yeah.
So how do you validate the difference between an influencer and an everyday Joe?
So that's kind of a tough question. But really what it is, when you deal with influencers, all you're really doing is borrowing their trust that they have with their followers. So it doesn't really matter who they are. It's just that they have to be authentic.
Yeah.
If they're not authentic, none of it will work.
Yeah.
Because if it's not real, the followers will know that.
Yeah.
But people, like, for example, doing podcasting, when you put a commercial on this thing, like, hey, blah, 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 thank you for the sponsorship, people aren't going to go, I'm never going to listen to this ever again. They know why you're in podcasting. They know why they're trying to increase their followers.
Yeah.
But as you go smaller, micro and nano, the authenticity actually increases. They know it's real. That's why it's getting more effective when you go to the lower followers.
Yeah, we also have analytics and insights on their profiles. So engagement rate, engagement, like how many sponsors they've worked with. So you can see if they're actually real influencers from those numbers.
That's cool.
Yeah.
And I love that about technology and where we're at. There's a lot of things I dislike about technology, even as a web developer. But one of the things I do love about technology is the usage of data to quantify the success, failure, or conversion of campaigns, of how something's actually working for us. Whereas, like, you go out and get a billboard, you go, looks good.
Right.
I mean, there are ways to track that, you know, by how you follow up with your customers. Right. Like, where'd you hear us? How'd you know about this or whatever?
Right.
But television, I mean, you can know how many impressions you get, but you don't know. Whereas with technology, like certain social channels and that kind of thing, you can see what's the click-through rate.
Right.
You can see what is the engagement on that post. You can see other things that bring value.
Yeah.
If you were talking to, let's break this into two categories. Let's first start with, if you're talking to an influencer,
yeah,
what are two things that they need to do right now to make sure that they're setting themselves up for success well?
What, any level, I guess?
Sure. If we're talking to an influencer that's already established, they're going to know what's working, what isn't. So
yeah, true.
Somebody that's coming newer to the influencer space, what do they need to know?
The very first thing is that an influencer has to realize that they are transitioning into an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
Because your followers are no longer your clients.
Yeah.
The sponsors are.
Yeah.
So really acting like an entrepreneur and presenting yourself as a business right away, rather than thinking like, oh, I'll take a picture. That's cute, you know? You really have to go like, that's my sponsor, so what's my value proposition for them? What am I going to do? What makes me so different than other influencers? You have to be able to present that right away. You have to present your pricing, all that stuff you have to think through before doing anything else. Because if you're just going out there and someone asks like, hey, I'd like to work with you, and you don't know what to answer, that you're not gonna look good. And so, you know, you're not as effective.
Yeah, I agree that one of the biggest things is this: what makes you stand apart from the rest of the competition? Like, what makes you unique? What's your niche? And I think that's something you need to focus on, because if you are just like everybody else, what makes you, why can't I just go to someone else versus you?
30 seconds. If I am a person coming in that wants to use influencers to get my message out, a sponsor or a whatever you want to call them, what's one thing I need to know?
As a sponsor when going on our platform?
Just in general. If I'm trying to build a relationship with an influencer to use that, what do I need to know to make sure I get success out of what I'm trying to...
So you have to see influencers as a tool, a platform. Everyone kind of got familiar with, you know, Gary Vaynerchuk's jab, right?
Yeah.
So you have to see influencers not as a one-time thing.
Yeah.
It has to be a long-term thing. So if you can do a long-term kind of engagement with the influencer, it's a lot more effective than just going like, oh, let me get this influencer. Now this one. It's less effective. So if you can create a relationship... just like any type of sponsorships, that is more effective.
I would say make sure they're real followers, because some influencers have fake followers, right? So you got to make sure you can easily get that. You can pay for that. So that's one thing that you should make sure they're real by looking at their engagement rates.
Where can people find you?
We are at paidexposure.com, and our social media is all paid exposure.
Awesome. Final question for both of you. What is one dream that each of you want to still fulfill in your own life?
In my own life.
Dream. Whoa. Well, I actually have a nonprofit foundation for suicide prevention. So really helping that, using the platform for this, increasing the awareness would be great, because I lost my brother to suicide. And that's what my apparel is about. And that's what the nonprofit is about. So that's what we're doing. Yeah.
Completely off topic, but I want to see if aliens exist. I want to see if aliens exist. I want to go to outer space, and I want to see if aliens exist. So hopefully that'll be in our lifetime, right? Yeah, thank you.
Ricardo, Dennis, so great to have you on this little micro episode.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Once again, we want to thank Ricardo and Dennis of Paid Exposure for being on the show with us today. You can check them out at paidexposure.com. In a moment, we're going to be back, and we're going to be looking at some of our favorite moments from Season 3 of JumbleThink. We'll be right back. To Today's show is sponsored by our friends over at Penji. Here is a little bit more about Penji. Penji helps startups, agencies, small businesses, big corporations, marketing teams, and more achieve more with unlimited graphic design support at one flat monthly rate. Their easy-to-use online platform pairs you with a professional designer and lets you create as many design projects as you want. Think of it as your monthly subscription to top-notch design with no contracts, no hourly billing, just fast, simple, and affordable graphic design for all of your needs. And as a listener of JumbleThink, they are doing something awesome. They're going to give you 15% off your first month. All you have to do is head on over to Penji, PENJI.co, and use the code Jumble. So head on over and get the design you want. Now let's jump back into today's show. We are back, and a lot more to today's show. As I mentioned, this is the last episode of Season 3, but you don't have to wait long for Season 4. It's right around the corner. Kicking off Thursday with a double episode, a look into Season 4, and then our first guest, Jen Lederer. To wrap up Season 3, we wanted to take a moment and look back at some incredible conversations we had with some new friends and old friends. To kick this look back off, we are looking back at one of the really, really fun interviews we got to do in Season 3. It's with Dina Castor, who is one of the fastest women in the world when it comes to long-distance running. She has the American record in like the half and full marathons. This is a very fun conversation because whether you're a runner or not, we talk about something that's really important. That's called flow. Flow is this place where everything's working and firing as it should be. And whether you're a runner or you're a business owner, a coach, a writer, when you hit these moments of flow, it's like you're operating in this perfected place of purpose and destiny. Now, if you're a runner, you're going to really enjoy this conversation because we get into a lot of the stories behind being an elite runner, an elite athlete. So let's go ahead and join the conversation with Dina Castor. One of my favorite quotes in the book is, many people describe flow as effortless, but a race is always an effort. Flow to me was the absence of resistance. When you push into a pace and find nothing in the way of your pursuit, it's movement in its most freeing form.
Yes.
I love that quote. I just found that super powerful because whether you're a runner or whether you are a cyclist, whether it's not even a sports endeavor, there are these places of flow in which you're just operating in like where you were created to do.
Yes.
So talk to us about that.
I've probably felt flow a dozen times in the 30 something years wow. I've been in this sport, but you always pursue it. It's what every athlete pursues, what any person pursues when they go through the agony of preparing for a presentation and they do it while standing on the kitchen table in front of the mirror on their drive to work. And they're doing it in every instance throughout the day and it's painful. They are forgetting things. They're picking up the script and remembering that very critical word they left out in their opening statements. And they finally get to the front of that room and they deliver the presentation as if it was just this edited recording, this beautifully edited recording. That's flow. That's when you're just in it. You slept well and you ate well and your mind is just honed into the task. That it's much like that in running too. You get out there and you struggle and you grind and you push through day after day. And then you get this one day that everything is in sync in your body and you can just keep pushing and pushing and nothing's telling you to stop or to slow down. And you feel as if you can run forever. And those days it's like feeling of ecstasy. It's a beautiful feeling, but it only comes with really great preparation.
Yeah. That's so, so good. Preparation is so critical to what you do. I loved the picture that you shared of how you visualized your races by laying in a room or wherever you were and just mentally going through what you were about to do. Whether it was a month out, a year out, you were mentally going through the course and all of that. What are some ways as people who are listening who may be interested, they may be younger, going, hey, I've always thought running would be something I would really love to do and they want to get into it, or someone who's been running for years, maybe not competitively, but finds joy in it. What would you tell them about running to either set them up for success for the long haul or to take them to the next level in their journey of running?
Yeah, I think that that's a great question because I want everyone to be a runner. So we'll spread this word. I think that to start with an intention, what is it that you want to get out of running? And I think the beauty of running is you can get anything out of it that you want. The solitude, the socialism, the troubleshooting and solution finding. And so to set that intention as to what you want from putting in that routine. Do you just want to lose 5 pounds? So once you get there, you're done? Or is this part of your lifestyle of maybe the time where it's more of a meditation for you? You get to think through your day, what you did well, what you can improve on. It just gives you the headspace to be able to do that and to then see yourself doing it. See yourself disciplined enough to wake up 30 minutes before your alarm typically goes off and make it easy to get right into those running shoes and out the door. Get a timer for your coffee pot so that it's there to wake you either before the run or after the run, whenever you choose to make it. Make the routine of running really easy to follow through with, because that's part of the trick in setting new routines, is making sure, you know, if you want to learn the guitar and the guitar is shoved way back in your guest room closet, the chances are that you're not going to go through those extra steps to get the guitar out. But if it's just sitting on your bed and you're getting ready to go to bed, you're like, I should strum this a few times before I lay down. So really making the routine easy and effortless for you to continue to follow through with.
We usually do rapid fire questions. We're going to do those in a minute, but I have a couple specific rapid fire questions that are running focused. So
I am so bad. I'm going to disclose how bad I am with rapid fire questions because I am so long-winded whenever I answer a question. I'll be okay. Rapid fire. Go. Running related.
The race or win or whatever it was in your career that brought you the most joy.
The Chicago Marathon in 2015, when I was very much past my prime.
What for you is the difference between, you've run track and field, you've run cross country, you've done road racing and long distance running. For you, how do you process those differently?
I think that cross country and the track, you're performing for a stadium or a crowd, and road racing and the marathon, you are running amongst a community.
Oh, I love that. What's your favorite?
Road racing for sure. It used to be cross country because I love the grit and the challenge of the terrain. But I've become very deeply connected in the community as a whole of running, and that seems to be where road racing and marathoning lie.
You have set so many American records. You've set landmark goals that others try to strive to achieve from. You've become a legend and a inspiration for others. But what's that barrier you want to break for yourself right now?
Oh, boy. I'd like to get to flow one more time. I would love that.
Remind people one more time how they can find your book or connect with you for that matter.
You can find my book at your local bookstore or on Amazon. And with me, you can get in touch with me through my website, dinacaster.com.
There is a lot more to this conversation with Dina Caster, and you should go check it out. Head on over to jumblethink.com, check out season 3, episode 225. We talk more about the athlete's lifestyle and finding that perfect place of flow. Super, super fun conversation. One of the other things about being a podcaster is that it gets to open up opportunities to speak to heroes, personal heroes, people who have impacted your life and that are people we might not typically be able to sit down and talk with. This next interview is one of those people for me. His name's Erwin McManus. He is an author, he is a pastor, and he is impacting people around the world. This interview is super cool. We get to talk about his new book. We get to talk about finding purpose, Let's go ahead and join the conversation with Erwin McManus.
There is a specific process where it's you see the future, see the thing that you're created to step into that next season, and then it's not immediate. And I think in our culture, in our society, often we feel like there should be an immediate response. There should be an immediate transition. So how do you process that transition in having one foot in the past, one foot in the future? There's a lot of tension in that. So how do you process that? How do you navigate that?
Well, right now I'm 60 years old, and I already have, well, I've had for at least 8 years plans for what I'm doing in my 70s.
Wow.
The career that I intend to develop and to live in my 70s. And so I think some of it is one, rejecting the notion that you have limitations from achieving the dreams that are in your life. Just because other people don't think you can do it, just because it's hard, or just because you are not prepared today, doesn't mean that you cannot prepare yourself. And so a huge part of it is I look for things where I love the process.
Okay.
I always tell people, if you only love the outcome, that's not your dream. That's something you envy.
Mm.
And if you love the process of actually becoming good at something, the process of becoming great at something, then you've actually found a dream that can become your life. And so some of it for me is, okay, what are the areas I'm willing to do the hard, gritty, ugly, behind the scenes work to get really good at something long before anyone ever sees the outcome?
Wow.
The other thing I look at is who are people who are living the life and doing the things, accomplishing the things that I want to do. And I begin to study them. They become my mentors, even though they don't know me.
Wow.
I never felt like anybody needed to choose me. I choose them to be my mentors. And so I pay attention. I go learn everything I can in that industry. And I just, I have never stopped going to school. Okay. I've been learning all my life, you know? And so when I wanted to become a writer, I spent years, but I started developing my writing skills when I was around 10 years old. I began writing short stories. I began writing novels. I began writing fiction and developing that craft even then in my life. But it took me 30 years before it became a career. Now, I had publishers come talk to me when I was 29, asked me to start writing then. And I said, no. I said, I'm going to wait 10 more years because I didn't want to just write. I wanted to be a writer.
Okay.
And a lot of people have a goal of selling a book or becoming an author. I didn't have a goal of being an author. My goal was to write the timeless. I wanted to write literature. And I wanted my writing to be world class. And I think a lot of the problem is you want to do things fast. You actually just want to be successful. You don't want to be great.
Mm.
And a lot of times people want to have instantaneous success. But you can't create something that's timeless, truly beautiful, has the essence of greatness, and do it fast. If you want to be a great filmmaker, then keep working at it for 20 years. If you want to be a great communicator, then keep working at it for 20 years and realize that the skills that you admire never come fast. It takes years and years and years of discipline and determination and honing that craft.
Yeah, we often say on the podcast, you have to go slow to go fast. If you want to go fast, slow it down. Mm-hmm. Just wait and marinate in what you're doing. And you mentioned doing and enjoying that process. You know that it's the next step when you enjoy the process, not I have to arrive right away.
Yeah, and especially if you're doing something you love, you've already arrived.
Okay.
Yeah, you see, it's only when you're looking from the outside that you think success is when the person feels they've arrived. In fact, it's really funny. I think about 2 years ago, I was speaking at a conference, and it was a faith conference. And they did this interview with me afterwards. And in the interview, they said, so how do you, you've just spoken at our conference. How do you deal with achieving this level of success? And I looked at it and I said, I didn't know that speaking at this conference was achieving my measure of success.
Yeah.
I thought I was successful before I spoke at your conference.
Yeah.
And this conference deals with public perception. It does not deal with private reality.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this is a part of the problem is that we keep thinking celebrity is actually success.
Yeah.
And it's not.
Yeah. I think you went into a lot of detail about that journey in Last Arrow, which I really loved seeing that because you see, for people like me who look to you as a person who is a hero in our faith in the Christian journey, a modern day hero, it's easy to go and say, look at how successful it is because he's done all these things. But it's always interesting to see that internal dialogue that you're having and how you're defining success and the measure of success. You're setting the standard and not allowing the outside forces to define it for you. And you talk a little bit about that in your new book.
The Way of the Warrior.
Way of the Warrior. Yeah. Thank you. You're talking a little bit about that too, about the there's an internal peace that has to be found in the journey of creating what you're supposed to create and finding the fights, the battles that you're supposed to fight. You're fighting for something, not against something. And then finding that peace is the ultimate place in which you find breakthrough. Talk to us a little bit about that and finding peace in the journey of the tension of often we strive for things or we're afraid to step into it. And yet that's where we're called to go.
Yeah, I think it's actually Jim Carrey who's quoted as saying something like, I wish that everyone would become rich and famous so they would know it's not what they're looking for.
That's a brilliant idea.
Yeah, you know, and I think a part of the reality is that you can't fix the problems inside of you by anything in the world outside of you.
Yeah.
That a huge part of what drives us oftentimes for success or fame or wealth or power or a celebrity or identity is that there's stuff inside of us that's missing. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a difference between a person who becomes externally successful when they are internally healthy.
Yeah.
Because that success is not the measure of their identity. It really just becomes a platform from which they can do more good in the world.
Yeah.
But when your external success is the source of validation, it's trying to replace the missing essence that your soul desperately needs, the sense of meaning and tension, the sense of value and significance that your soul is trying to grapple with, you just become a black hole and it's never enough. It's never enough. It's never enough.
Wow.
And I see this all the time.
Yeah.
Guys who are just trying to, they're chasing success. They're chasing the money. They're chasing the fame. They're chasing the girl. They're chasing the stuff. And they're just, but they're running with all this emptiness inside of them. And a huge part of why I wrote The Way of the Warrior is because when you talk about things like, okay, how do you deal with the internal mess of your soul? Like your anxiety, your stress, your panic attacks, your depression, your sense of despair, you know, that paralyzing sense of insignificance that so many entrepreneurs are even trying to hide inside of them. And how do you deal with that stuff when you think you're supposed to just kind of like man up or toughen up? And that's why I think it's so important that even the book is called The Way of the Warrior. It's saying, hey, these issues are not a sign of weakness. They're actually a sign of strength when you own the fact that this is the most important battle in your life. That, you know, and it's one of you that if I wrote a book, no man would ever read it, first of all, if it said, I don't know, healing your broken self.
Yeah.
No guy's going to carry it around, you know? And I said, no, this is the way of the warrior.
Right.
The deep inner battles of your soul, it's a noble battle that needs to be won.
Yeah.
And by the way, like this, to me, this book is dealing with the most important battle in the world because we're never going to have world peace until we have inner peace.
Right.
You're never going to have healthy relationships until you have a healthy soul.
Yeah.
You're never going to be able to be generous in the world until you learn how to be whole within yourself.
Right.
And because greed is really driven by an internal need to fill the vacuum in your soul with stuff. And if your soul is still empty, you'll never have enough stuff. But when you're whole, when you find that wholeness that comes from a deep inner peace, then no matter how much you have, you're always going to be generous. Yeah. And that's a beautiful thing.
There's much more to this conversation with Erwin McManus. If you are our dreamer, if you have ideas, if you want to find purpose and destiny, you need to check out the rest of this conversation. The best way to do it, head on over to jumblethink.com. check out season 3, episode 213, and continue listening to the rest of that conversation. We're going to take a break right here, and when we get back, we're going to dive into more of our favorite moments from season 3 of JumbleThink. We'll be right back. The passion of JumbleThink is very simple. We believe that all of us were created for purpose, that the dreams and ideas inside of us matter, and that we need to step into that, not only for ourselves, but for the world around us. One of the ways we do that is through this podcast, but we also are launching some really, really, really cool events. One of those is called Idea Camps, and we want you to be a part of virtual Idea Camps coming this February. Whether you're wrestling through an idea that's been a lifelong pursuit or a new dream that's just been birthed, we want you to be a part. Head on over to jumblethink.com/virtualideacamps to learn more. Now let's jump back into today's conversation. We are back and we are continuing our look back at season 3 of JumbleThink and some of our favorite conversations. If you're like me, as a child, you probably watched movies like Indiana Jones and Jurassic Park. There was this sense of adventure and exploration, discovery. For many of us, it was the dream of our lives to go out and be that explorer, to find lost treasures, to find ancient animals that were buried deep in the earth. But many of us aren't living that life. Our next guest is, his name's Walter Stein. He is the founder of Paleo Adventures. I got to go out and dig dinosaur bones with him, and then we got to sit down and talk about his life, his discoveries, and what he's doing. Let's join a part of our conversation with Walter Stein. Tell us a little bit about some of the experiences you've had out there in the field with people when they've come out along for the journey of digging those dinosaurs. Tell us some of those stories of just whatever that looks like, whether it's a funny story, an exciting story, but what people experience.
Well, let's see. With Paleo Adventures, we've gotten lots of good stories, some good ones and some scary ones, yeah. I guess.
It's a great cactus story.
The cactus story is good. I don't know if you should maybe end with that one.
Yeah, let's do that.
There was this one time we had, there was this one section of the quarry that no one seemed to want to work in. We take them right to a quarry. We show them the tools, the techniques.
Well, and I want to pause you there. When people think quarry, I know when I heard you talk about it when I was doing research for the episode prior to actually coming out with you, I'd see this word quarry, and I think strip mine. I think mines going down into earth. And so I think of quarrying from that stone standpoint. That's not what it's like. It is like what you see on some of the movies and stuff like that,
right,
where you're in beautiful nature settings, and you're just chipping away at little sections of dirt to find that little nugget of treasure.
Yeah, quarry is just anywhere where you're removing rock and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
An excavation site, a dig site.
Yeah.
Each one of the locations where we find fossils, we designated a certain name and a certain handle or something.
Yeah, tooth draw.
Tooth draws.
Which is the one that we're at. And if you want to see a picture of that, again, head on over to jumblethink.com.
Yeah.
We'll have some pictures right there of Walter actually pulling out, I think it was an arm bone of some sort.
Can't remember. It's been a couple of days and we found lots of other stuff in between.
Well, there was a bone there. It was pretty big and he pulled it out. It was pretty cool. And so we have a picture of him cleaning that bone off there. That's going to be right there. You're going to be able to check that out. So anyway, sorry.
Very cool.
Continue.
I'll have to
double
check that.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's see. You know, we were in the tooth draw quarry, and one of the things that tooth draw is well known for is that it has a high number of tyrannosaur teeth.
Yeah.
As well as triceratops teeth and duckbill teeth. And so there's a whole lot of them in there. And most are, you know, reasonable average size. Well, there was this one part of the quarry where nobody seemed to want to go, and I kept trying to direct people over there. And whenever they did get over there, they always kind of dug uphill.
Oh.
And it's hard to describe that
for
this, but on a podcast. But basically, you see the quarry wall is 2-3 feet high, and you see a little bone sticking out of the top, and everybody goes for that little bone that they see.
Yeah.
They don't always dig all the way to the bottom of the channel. and get some of the stuff that's at the bottom. Sometimes yeah. the stuff at the bottom is better.
Stuff at the top is usually what you call drifters, right?
Drifters
usually,
float. Yeah, float. Yeah, yeah, fragments and yeah. such. Well, anyway, I kept saying, dig down right here.
Yeah.
Nobody would. It, and even one of my good friends from Florida, I got some friends down. We snowbird back and forth to Florida because, of course, you can't dig dinosaur bones when there's 2 feet of snow on the ground. So we hang out down in Florida in the wintertime and became good friends with some of the Fossil Club folks down there, the Southwest Florida Fossil Society.
Yeah.
And one of the vice president there came out with us on a dig.
Mm.
And I put him in that area.
Yeah.
And I said, dig down. Nobody's getting to the bottom of the channel. He's like, yeah. Oh, yeah, okay, Walter, no problem. So for 3 days, he did not dig down. He kept digging into the side of the wall. Well, they went home. They went back to Florida. And then a couple days later, we had this 9-year-old boy.
It's always the kids.
It's always these kids. They got some good luck. And I put that 9-year-old boy in that quarry. This was back before we raised the age to 10 and up.
Yeah.
So you know. Yeah, because those 9-year-olds, they kept finding all kinds of cool stuff. Yeah. But no, but anyway, this 9-year-old boy is sitting in the quarry, and he actually did listen to what I told him. And he was using the right techniques, and he was using the right tools. And he started digging downwards, and within probably less than 30 minutes, he came up with a 5-inch T-Rex tooth.
Wow.
Absolutely beautiful, flawless, perfect from the tip, had part of the root to it. And of course, he was very excited. Everybody was excited. And so now every time we go to a Southwest Florida Fossil Club meeting, I have to tell my friend that he was sitting on a 5-inch T-Rex tooth for a whole week.
Wow. Must have broken his heart.
Yeah. He probably was a couple inches above that. Yeah.
Wow. So the moral of the story is listen to Walter when he says, dig down.
Yes, exactly. Listen to Walter. That is the moral of most stories, isn't it?
Oh, you know, we always like to talk about business as a part sure. of what we do. And one of the things that every entrepreneur, every business owner struggles with is struggles. So what is the big struggle that you guys are facing right now that you're trying to overcome?
Sure. You know, well, we're facing a lot of the same things that every small business faces. We're to the point, we've been so pretty successful over the years. We've been getting more and more guests every year. I think we're taking 400 or 500 people out a year now. And we've just been growing and growing and growing. And now we're to that point where every business has to make that final decision. Do we want to get bigger or is this good enough? Are we content here at this level? We're comfortable. Everything's fine. Or do we want to take it to the next level? Start hiring a whole bunch of help, get a bigger facility, and so on and so forth. And I go back and forth on that issue. So I guess sometimes the biggest problem we face is me. You know, not only is it difficult to make that leap of faith, for every entrepreneur, it's difficult to take that leap of faith, to take it to the next level, but it's also, for me, I'm a bit of a control freak. So I want to make sure the quality stays the same. Yeah. I want to make sure everybody gets there safely and has a nice, happy, healthy time.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to send 2-3 trucks to a different ranch and something happens, you know, and, you know, because it is a dangerous environment we're out in. So, I'm very particular about how we dig and what we do and how we split things into science and for science and commerce and for common, so fossils.
Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit. So one of the things that you say often when we were prepping to go out, when you were out in the field, like there are three kinds of fossils we're going to find today. Mm-hmm. We're going to find common, we're going to find commercial, and we're going to find museum or academic fossils. So tell us a little bit about, well, let me back up. For those of you listening who are going paleontology, go find bones. That's true, but there is another layer of that, and that's the politics of dinosaur hunting, because you have academic versus commercial, and yep. commercial being the finding and selling of fossils and everything like that. So in your desire to find an ethical balance of that, you've created these three different subsets.
Right.
Talk to us about that and what that looks like.
Well, you know, for the last 3, 4, 5 decades, there's been this unfortunate controversy between the academic side of paleontology and the more independent or commercial side. And there's more than two. There's actually a third. There's avocationalists. Avocationalists are people who love fossils. They go out and they hunt for fossils, but they just do it for themselves. They're not, okay. They don't do it. They do it maybe part-time.
Yeah.
So they'll have a full-time job, and then they'll go off on the weekends with a club or somebody, and they'll go find some fossils.
Yeah.
Academics typically are going to have their PhDs. They've gone the whole distance. They've got their golden ticket up hanging on the wall.
Yeah.
They've put in the time. They've put the 8 years of time in, and they're brilliant folks. But they primarily are going to be teaching at university or museum, and so they don't get nearly as much field time as someone like myself. Now, on the independent side, independent and commercial were... that's a good way to describe us. A ragtag group of individuals who are very individualistic,
yeah.
Who don't like to sit at board meetings and don't like to get permission from boards of directors and things like that.
To fight for funding and then the release of that funding and then...
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And so you get these three branches, the academic, the avocational, and the commercial or the independent. And you've got good apples and bad apples on all sides.
Yeah.
I've got lots of good friends in academia. They're brilliant scientists. They do everything the right way. They're open-minded. They work with ranchers. We had a fourth group, the ranchers, who actually own the land out here.
Yeah.
They're great folks. But then there's a few others that they have some strange ideas about how you should get access to some of these places. there's one paleontologist running around out there saying we should use eminent domain to confiscate skeletons, confiscate lands that he thinks are scientifically significant. We have others that have set up the rules of publication so that you can only publish on publicly held specimens.
Wow.
Which really restricts a lot of the science. And it's a shame because paleontology gets held back into the dark ages when you only have 10 specimens to really study because some dinosaurs are extraordinarily rare.
Yeah, yeah.
Restricting when you only have 10 specimens and only three of them are in the public domain, and those
there's
are the only ones.
There's not much to look at.
Yeah, when you're doing these detailed ecological studies of an ancient environment, you need more specimens. The more specimens you have, the greater the chances your conclusions or your hypothesis is closer to the truth.
So
you have that, and then on the other hand, you have some good commercial folks, and then you've got a few rogues out there that I wouldn't turn my back on.
Wow.
You know, they're trespassing. They go into somebody's land, they rip stuff off out of the ground, and they sell it for eBay for pennies on the dollar. So I think both extremes have gone off the reservation, so to speak.
Yeah.
And so we try and find a very comfortable, careful balance, a practical balance. In my opinion, it's more of a common sense approach to this, where we find the best use for every fossil.
Yeah.
Because... You know, like we were talking about earlier, the common fossils, the commercial grade, or the scientific grade.
Yeah.
We split them into those three categories. And common stuff is a simple definition. We find it just about everywhere throughout the Hell Creek. Doesn't matter whether you're Hell Creek Formation.
Yeah.
Which is
South Dakota, Montana, North Dakota.
Right. It's a huge rock formation. It's usually about 100 meters thick.
Yeah.
So over 300 feet thick. It stretches across the states of South Dakota, North Dakota, Montana. Up, it goes north across the Canadian border. We call it the Frenchman Formation up there, but it's essentially the same thing.
Yeah,
it goes down through Denver and Wyoming. Down there, we call it the Lance Formation, and it goes into Denver, the Denver Formation. So they're all different parts of this ancient floodplain.
Yeah,
yeah. So anyway. And this rock unit is very, very extensive. I'm currently working on a research project trying to figure out, given our rate of collection and what we found over the people have found over the last 120 odd years of digging in it, how much more could still be buried out there.
Wow.
And part of that was able to calculate there are over 225,000 cubic kilometers of Hell Creek Formation that is still below the surface. Some of which is, of course, within reach.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I may have gotten to a square foot yeah. of dirt. Maybe. And that's probably generous, to be honest.
Yeah, maybe a square foot or two you got through in a day's worth of digging, yeah.
And I must have found four larger fragments. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, 3-4 inches down to an inch, mm-hmm. and then found some teeth and all that kind of stuff. So mm-hmm. for me, seeing what I was able to do in one day and know how much came out of that dirt right. goes, okay, if that's that, how many cubic feet there, just crazy amounts, there's so much to be discovered. I mean, it's going to take generations upon generations to be able to consume and categorize all of that.
Absolutely. I mean, we're really literally just scratching at the surface.
Wow.
We've been at the Tooth Draw Quarry now for over 10 years.
Yeah.
And you see how far we've dug back. I mean, on that quarry map, we've got a quarry map hanging on the wall. We've gone back maybe 8 meters.
Wow.
That's it.
Yeah.
And this same river channel we've mapped out over 100 yards, at least. It goes under where we parked the truck, shows up in the bathroom area. You find a few fossils down there every once in a while. And then over to the other place where we were digging at Tooth Draw West. So yeah. it's a very extensive unit. And, you know, if we keep digging, we're going to continue to find more stuff. And every one of those little bones we get is a piece to the puzzle of ancient life.
There is so much more to our conversation with Walter Stein. You should go check it out, especially if you love dinosaurs, adventures, discovery, and exploration. So head on over to jumblethink.com. Check out episode 247 of season 3. Our final conversation is with a friend of mine. And I don't get to sit down and have conversations all that often with guests who I've known for a long time. I've known Zach for probably close to 20 years now. Zach is the executive pastor at Jesus Culture. They are a church in Sacramento that was birthed out of a church in Redding, California. They are a global movement creating killer music that's used by churches around the world. But Zach recently started his own podcast talking about finding your purpose, finding adventure, finding the dreams you have. And that's where this conversation comes from that point of saying that we were all created for something awesome. So let's jump into our conversation with Zach Curry. One of the things that really stood out to me as I was listening to that first episode and I was listening to the second episode was this line that you said, and I think it was in the first episode, is that the podcast that you're creating is all about men understanding what it means to be known and fully alive.
Yeah.
And I think that's a powerful line, but it's pretty weighty and heavy. There's a lot to unpack there. So what does it mean as a man to be known? Let's start there.
Well, just to back up a little bit, Man Camp, the podcast, originated out of two places. One, just a conversation I was having with one of my friends in my kitchen.
Yeah.
And then connected to it, locally, we have what we call our men's community.
Yeah.
And we've been doing this for almost 3 years now, and this question that you're asking is something we've been diving into. And before the podcast ever started, we found out very quickly, and you know, it's not, I don't think it's new information, but and this is a generalization, but we found this to be very true in a lot of the men in our community, is that for the most part, for a lot of men, it's easier, the default or the trajectory is towards isolation compared to being known. And so when we say be known, becoming fully alive is one of the things we've just been going after. And I grew up in the church. I, to be honest, didn't like most men's groups. I thought they were boring. I didn't want to go to them right. because you're sitting in a room. So we try to do something different because I think there's an element in most men where like, hey, adventure. So when we say come alive, it's you're not, especially in the church community world, you're not just in the mundane status quo, 9 to 5, like whatever that looks like. And, you know, it's not just one thing, but you're excited about life. You're alive, not just actively, your mind, your soul, your spirit. There's things that you're looking forward to.
Yeah.
And what we found is a lot of men, well, maybe, you know, guys have a bent towards adventure. A lot of guys just aren't known because they don't want to sit in a room in a small group, read a book, and like share their hearts. They actually want to be known, but the way to get there is a little different. And so
I want to pause you there because we're using this word known,
But what does that really mean? Because from that standpoint, like, a lot of guys will be like, yeah, they know me. We watch football on Sundays, and we go to church together, and we watch sports with that our kids are playing. And so they know me. They know all the things I'm doing. They know the things I have coming up. But that's not what you're talking about.
Yeah.
So go a little bit deeper there and unpack what, like, that really means to be known, truly known.
So for us, it means that people know your story.
Okay.
They know. We and you can go even deeper into that, but most guys, like you're saying, can hang out together. You know their name. You know where they work. You know what's going on. You don't know your fears. You don't know what you're struggling with, whatever it may be.
Yeah.
We, as men, generally speaking, we'll stuff stuff down.
Yeah.
Hey, how you doing? I'm great. I'm okay.
When
that's not actually true.
Is that being caused by, you think, internal fears, or is it being like just a cultural thing, or is it just, hey, people don't really want to know? Where do you think that stems from? That being detached from being known by others.
Some of it, I think, is being it's detached from your emotions, because for this is again a stereotype, but for many men, emotions or showing emotion is connected to weakness.
Mm.
So that means we are afraid to be vulnerable because it appears like we're weak. Asking for help is a sign of weakness for many.
Yeah.
And yet the reality is we all need help. It doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter how old you are. It doesn't matter if you're man, woman, child. We all need help.
Yeah.
And, there's this thing. And we started using this phrase because what we started doing was just really simple, not rocket scientists. I'm sure a lot of people are doing this, but we just said, hey, as guys, we just did fun things. We rented an airplane hangar for our meeting, and we always have meat. We try to have fire. we're having fun. We're just connecting. And we ask guys to do two things. One is, hey, share your story.
Mm.
And there's no like requirement. You can go as deep as you want. It's not a template. We just like being known is like, hey, what's your story? Where'd you come from? Where are you going?
Yeah.
We found as guys began to just share their story, like, hey, here's me, good, bad, all that, like, there was it was enabled people to be vulnerable.
Wow.
And then after, we'd have these groups of guys that would do that. And then secondly, we said, what are your dreams? Like not just what you're doing, like not your job, not your financial goals, whatever, but what are your dreams? What are the things you want to go after? We would have guys write down 50 dreams.
Wow.
It's actually a lot harder than you would think.
What would that look like when you say write down 50 dreams? What are the kind of things that would be on that list?
It's a wide range. Some are short term, some are long term, some are I want to go skydiving. Some are connected to business or financial. We challenge people, dream big. They vary depending on the person. Like, I want to own a couple of homes so that I can provide for my kids, for college. Like, they vary, so it's hard to say. Like, for me, like, some dreams are like, there's a guy in one of the groups I was talking to, this, like, I want to own a buffalo ranch. I'm like, great, that's not my dream, but I love your dream,
Yeah, I have something like that right here. I'm up to 380 dreams right now of things, and they're wide ranging, and so it's kind of a little bit like a life list or a bucket list, but it's different.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, and I would say there's different categories. There's personal.
Yeah.
It may be connected to your health or relationships. There's professional. There's just fun and outlandish. Like, it's not a need, but this is true for anything. Like, when you set a goal or you actually write it down and articulate it, like, it actually becomes a lot more real. And, for someone, it sounds like you've been doing this for a while. It gets easier as you do it. But if right now I said, hey, sit down and write out 100 dreams, it would actually take you a while.
See, the thing is that even at 50 right now, it would be hard for me to come up with 50 more.
Totally.
I have a list of 380 right now, and a whole bunch are checked off and a whole bunch aren't. But it's not like I could just sit down and do 50 more on that list right now.
Having Zach on was a lot of fun. There is a lot more to this conversation. You can check out season 3, episode 251 with Zach. We get into culture and community and creativity and what it means to be a man. So much more. Go check it out. And all that to say, if you've missed any of season 3, season 3 has been our best season yet. And there's a lot to check out. But we aren't done yet.
We are diving into season 4, starting on Thursday with a preview show. And then on Friday, we have Jen Lederer on the show. It is super, super, super cool. We don't want you to miss any part of season 4, so what do you need to do? Head on over to jumblethink.com, subscribe to our newsletter so that you know about upcoming guests and interviews and cool things we are doing. And then head on over to Facebook, LinkedIn, and Instagram. Let's be friends. Let's chase dreams and ideas together. Doing it together is so much better. I believe you were created for something awesome, that the dreams and ideas that you have matter, that you have purpose, you have a destiny inside of you, and that the world needs you more than ever. So be a part of the JumbleThink community, where we get together and we dream big together, where we chase dreams together and we change the world together. Now it's your turn. We believe that you were created for greatness. So get out there. Get out into the world. Take those dreams. Step into them. Dream big and change the world around you. Lorsque vous aurez bien saisi la technique et que vous serez maître de votre corps, vous pourrez vous décontracter même en travaillant.